Next case is 95-2196, Terry Vahila versus Charles D. Hall.
May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, may I respectfully reserve on behalf of my time.
Quite your time there on the clock.
This story starts in 1991 when June and Terry Vahila retained the firm of Baker Nicholas and Duplicar in Canton on a number of matters. The firm of Baker Mikas and Dupagard and Charles Hollins Associate was approved counsel for Vitica Insurance. The firm was retained sometime in March of 1991 on a number of matters. This chart is appended as an exhibit to our memorandum of support jurisdiction. I only show it for illustration purposes. This chart was presented by Mr. Vahila when he went in. It demonstrated a myriad of legal problems, many of which were caused by Mrs. Vahila, and she sought counsel to solve those problems. The problem started with a lawsuit by somebody called Bill Hawk. It dealt with the insolvency of the oil and gas insurance company. It dealt with returns of premiums, potential counterclaims, cross-claims, and it dealt with cancellations. And there was a whole host of problems, probably 12 or 13 in number. At the same time that was going on, Mrs. Vahila was being monitored by the Ohio Department of Insurance, although it's not on the record. Sometime after this case was accepted on appeal, she has ultimately lost her license. Mrs. Vahila was also charged with a criminal offense of passing bad checks. At that time, there were valid defenses to that. Baker Nicholas and Duplicar, even though approved counsel for Utica, took on Mrs. Vahila's criminal offense as well. We made an argument on the issue of legal malpractice. And that argument that we present to you, to your honorable justices, is simply that, one, the Roberts case ought to be extended to legal malpractice. In these cases, this myriad of cases, some of these cases may have been won, some of these cases may have been lost, but what the record demonstrates that these cases were less pursued less than aggressively. Two, there were some counterclaims and some cross-claims were not pursued. And all of the representation was under a cloud of conflict of interest because the firm represented Utica Insurance. There's allegations that some coverage would have been removed, some coverage would have been withdrawn, that premiums are returned, and so forth. So, first off, we propose that there is no reason that the Roberts case ought not to be extended to the context of legal malpractice.
In the Roberts case, it was loss of chance of survival or recovery.
That's correct.
And in this case, what would it be called? Loss of chance to what? To win a case?
Loss of chance. Well, Ms. Justice Cook, what it would be called in this case is the loss of chance of saving your insurance license, of achieving a optimum result, lowering your damages.
You wouldn't really want to limit that to just legal malpractice, then wouldn't you probably want to have that for all tort cases, and we would just have, what would proximate causation be then for torts?
All right. In looking at the Roberts case, and looking at Chief Justice Moyer's dissent, I don't believe that the rule out would be extended to where a plaintiff is slow in his recovery. I think that's unworkable. But I think where there's a loss of chance, like in Cron versus Kinney, this court held that there is some merit in vindication of a person's criminal record. And you held in that court, that it wasn't necessary to obtain a reversal of the conviction. People go to lawyers.
You noted in that case that might not be, that we might hold, not hold similarly in a civil case.
I understand that. And what we would propose to you, my second point is that can be extended to a civil case because people go to lawyers not expecting often to win, but they do go to lawyers expecting to have their problems managed. This was a significant problem, admittedly, much of which was Mrs. Beacon's own doing. But they come to to counsel and they expect that problem to be managed. That's the reality.
So this is a mismanagement as opposed to traditional legal malpractice.
Traditional legal malpractice, as this court has held, at least in the civil context, is the but-for test. You must prove that you would have won a case. You would have won a case but for the negligence.
Or prove that you were damaged.
You were damaged by that. In this particular case, it's a myriad of problems, some of which maybe the plaintiff some of which maybe they would have lost. In the summary judgment papers themselves, we would submit to you that even the trial court and the appellate court found that there were questions of material fact.
Let's talk about that in the summary judgment. Procedurally, it appears that there was an affidavit secured from a defense expert, plaintiff's expert.
That's correct.
That said that the counsel here failed to act confidently, something such as that. But that affidavit apparently was not submitted in response to the motion for summary judgment. It was in the file, but it was not submitted, according to the Court of Appeals, it was not submitted in response to the motion for summary judgment.
Ms. Justice Cook, that was submitted in response.
Did you say it was?
It was, yes, and that it was filed in the common police court that was considered by the trial court. Both an affidavit of an expert on a civil matter and an expert on a criminal matter. In the context of summary judgment.
Yeah, you're arguing, you seem to be arguing the merits when in fact, I think we're only here on the question of whether or not you had enough in that record to get by summary judgment.
That's correct.
I mean, we can't really extend Robert's case or any other cases until the summary judgment issue is decided. If it's decided adverse to you, then it's over. If it's decided favorably towards you, then it goes back, doesn't it?
Right.
And that's all that we have here.
Right. And addressing that, to address the procedural point of the summary judgment, evidence was put on each of the elements, the traditional elements of legal malpractice. There was an affidavit from the criminal matter from Eric Mertz, who testified as to duty, proximate cause, breach of that duty, and causing damages. There was a similar affidavit from Ben Washington that contained all the items that were reviewed, an opinion as to the breach of that duty and proximate cause.
Well, but don't we have to, just to say send it back because of summary judgment is easy to do, but don't we have to tell the trial judge what legal test the trial judge uses? And your argument is the trial judge used the incorrect legal test in ruling on the summary judgment, isn't it?
Right.
And that brings us right to the legal issue that...
Well, the trial judge
Well, that then is a standard summary judgment argument, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay, but I thought your argument was that the trial judge used a test that is not the test you think should have been used.
The trial judge used the test of substantial likelihood of success, probably likelihood of success on the outcome. That isn't the test. The test is material issue of fact.
Well, no, that's just goes to proximate cause.
Right.
It goes to proximate causation.
That's correct.
And so the trial judge was relating to proximate causation, as the Chief Justice points out, that there was no, in as much as there was no like showing of a likelihood of success, that there was no showing of proximate cause.
No, the standard is material issue of fact.
As to, and he pointed out that there was no, the plan could not show proximate cause, and there was no, and that thereby there was no issue of material fact shown because there could be no showing of proximate cause.
I understand. That's our problem with the trial.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carlin. Mr. Perlman.
My name is Jay Perlman. I'm the Cleveland office of Alderman Burns. I represent Calhese in this matter. As the justices have pointed out, this case is about proximate cause. This case may be about the standard for proximate cause, presuming for the moment that threshold evidence was even produced for proximate cause in the legal and the trial relative to summary judgment in this legal malpractice case. Of course, since the briefings in this case, this court has rendered the decision in Rogers v. Ohio Permanent in the medical malpractice death situation. While that court case has not been brought to this court's attention by supplemental briefs, we've already begun discussing it, and I have no objection that we continue to discuss it if it becomes pertinent to the issue of burdens or reversal on the proximate cause issue. However, this court need not get to that standard because threshold evidence on the proximate cause issue was not presented to the trial court. Going back briefly to the facts of the case against my clients. Nine separate cases were the subject of claims of legal malpractice. In none of the circumstances was evidence of proximate cause pursued or developed before the trial court. Lots of statements were made, just like the statement of counsel a moment ago. The alleged negligence may have caused damage. The alleged negligence may have caused damage. However, none of the acts that were claimed should have been done by counsel in any of these nine cases were ever done in furtherance of the legal malpractice case under consideration now. The depositions that arguably should have been taken were not taken in support of the malpractice case. Accordingly, all we are left with is pure speculation as the proximate cause. More to the point, Ohio law is clear that in order to establish the various elements, and specifically the proximate cause element of a legal malpractice case, one must establish that through expert testimony. Going back historically through the decisions of this court first addressed the requirement of expert testimony on the standard of care side as many years ago as the K.B. Rodman. That has been extended over the last 10 years by this court to the proximate cause element of a claim. And it's clear, and we reference cases in our materials, including the Nelson case, which demonstrate that it must be spoken by an expert. An expert must opine as to proximate cause. Not in our materials, but announced within the last 2 weeks, the Hamilton County Court of Appeals made that very statement in a case announced within the last 2 weeks. That being the case, turn now to the affidavits of experts appended in opposition, attached in opposition in the trial court in opposition to summary judgment. Counsel is correct. Two affidavits were attached, an affidavit of Mr. Mertz regarding criminal matters, an affidavit of Mr. Wasserman regarding civil matters. The statements in those affidavits had to do with standard of care, standard of care, standard of care, standard of care. But in recognition of the fact that an expert must also speak to proximate cause, the last paragraph of each affidavit said, oh, and by the way, we believe the violations of standard of care referenced above proximately caused the damages alleged. Such conclusory assertion on the part of an expert need not be considered under the law and was not considered by the trial court. The Court of Appeals affirmed under Evidence Rule 705 the propriety of not considering the conclusory statements relative to proximate cause in the last paragraph of both affidavits. Based upon that affirmation and the law in support of that affirmation enclosed in our merit brief, this court need go no further this morning and simply say no admissible evidence, admissible meaning in satisfaction of Rule 705, has been presented to the trial court of proximate cause as required for a necessary element of the plaintiff's claim. Therefore, summary judgment should be affirmed based on the absence of threshold evidence as to that element. We can stop here for a moment, by the way. I'd like to take a moment before the court. To the extent that this court would go further, to the extent the court believes that...
Can you go back, counsel, to the argument that these statements, that these affidavits of the experts that have, quote, bald assertions about proximate cause. You know, the rule just says that the affidavits have to have the facts and the data underlying the opinion. This viewpoint of the Court of Appeals maybe is a new viewpoint that one has to go further on the damages. This use of Rule 705.
Oh.
Have you seen that in opinions from our court?
No. Court of Appeals referenced two other Court of Appeals opinions, Jones v. AGT Enterprises and Stamper v. Middleton Hospital. We reference in our materials also the decision at the appellate level of State v. Lissac. Those three opinions each stand for the proposition at the Court of Appeals level that an expert must reveal the basis, the underlying facts and basis for his conclusion. No, I do not have an opinion by this court. I don't think this court has addressed the issue.
You haven't really said that.
I don't think this court has addressed it either way. Yes, you have not said that.
Does the Court of Appeals opinion have the flavor that a non-moving party seemingly must prove their case at the summary judgment level? All through that Court of Appeals opinion says they didn't prove this, they didn't point to that, they didn't show that this damage was there. Isn't that what trial is about?
Well, particularly subsequent to this court's announcement of Burton and Drescher, in which one must go further in support of summary judgment, right, as I understand it now, than a mere showing or than a mere pointing out of areas of burden. Nonetheless, Pelley has produced affidavits in support of not only the absence of violation of standard of care, but the absence of causation of damages. I think that clearly shifts the burden just to a threshold. There's got to be some threshold level of evidence historically under summary judgment standards, including that supported in Berkeley Drescher, before an issue of fact is created. There is a lower level in which there is just speculation. Absent threshold evidence, there is just speculation. Now, it's my understanding of this appeal that if any evidence was presented, then we need to deal with what's the threshold. And what's the threshold is the issue about which the Roberts case may be pertinent. That is to say, should this court extend loss of chance or loss of opportunity beyond the medical malpractice dead circumstance if this court believes any evidence was presented on the subject? To the extent this court agrees that no admissible evidence was presented on the subject, we need not go further. Turning to Roberts, and really turning to the issue of proximate cause generally, loss of opportunity generally. As this court is well aware, the Roberts decision is self-limiting. The conclusory paragraph of Roberts says we only address this subject, not other areas of tort law. Further, all of the cases cited in Roberts from other jurisdictions were likewise medical malpractice death cases. To the extent that we go to this argument, appellant requests the court adopt loss of chance in legal malpractice circumstances, please allow this analysis. Initially, and in all candor, intellectually, a loss of chance analysis is at least intellectually conceivable or possible beyond the med malpractice death situation. It's possible, as the justice asked opposition counsel, it's possible to lose chance for anything. It's possible to lose chance, in this case, for financial recovery, to lose chance to defend the lawsuit, to lose chance not to slip and fall. It's possible to lose an opportunity in a circumstance in which probable cause does not rise to the level of more likely than not or probability. However, we recommend that this court not obviate proximate cause across the board in the world of torts and in the world of causation generally. Noting the tone of the Roberts decision, the motivation, as I understand it, before this court for loss of chance in a medical malpractice situation was humanitarian. It had to do with the seriousness of the circumstances in a medical malpractice death situation. It had to do with survival. Had to do with the value of life. And I think that motivation ought to establish a limit to the extension of the loss of chance doctrine. Respecting this court's humanitarian motives in announcing the Roberts decision, we fully understand that humanitarian motives regarding survival may apply in certain other situations. They can apply beyond medical malpractice. An example in a Virginia case from the 1960s had to do with a boat in which someone fell off and the captain didn't search for the person who fell off. The defense was he probably was long dead. Nothing has established proximate cause. In that horrible situation, humanitarian motives might be brought to bear relative to survival, relative to death. And that captain might be held liable to the extent negligence was established. We recommend that this court not go beyond the survival circumstance, the humanitarian motive permeating the Roberts decision. We recommend that while this court is not currently facing the captain who didn't search for a fallen passenger, that this court not extend the situation to financial circumstances. We're dealing with financial circumstances here. Legal malpractice, recovery, non-recovery, defense, prosecution in nine separate cases. Criminal and civil. We are not dealing with survival. We are not dealing with life and death. Historically, the proximate cause standard in Ohio has been but-for, has been probability, has been more likely than not. That's the standard that Cronby-Kinney used, that this court utilized in Cronby-Kinney, not the misstated standard by appellate counsel. Cronby-Kinney involved the certainty of a criminal record. That wasn't more likely than not. That was certain. That certainly satisfied more likely than not. I request that this court affirm, and if it should choose to address the standard issue, that it should hold that the more likely than not proximate cause standard remains the law in non-survival situations and that the loss of chance doctrine not be adopted for torts generally or legal malpractices.
Right after the trial court, in its opinion, cited Cronby-Kinney, the case that you argue most vigorously. The statement is made, plaintiff must support the claim with expert testimony, also must establish that, absent the alleged negligent conduct, plaintiff would have been successful at trial. Now, accepting for argument that you may be right, and you may very well be right about your analysis, that's not a correct statement, is it? That is not a correct statement. That what you have to do is show your
trial judge.
Yes. Right after they cited the case, right after the trial judge cited Ron B. Kinnon. In his opinion, he said that that standard is the claims, you have, the plaintiff has to show that they would have been successful at trial. That's not the standard for summary judgment, is it?
No, the standard is threshold level. Okay. To that extent, Your Honor,
that's what it says.
This court can affirm even if some portion of the reasoning below.
I understand the rules.
I know you do.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman. Mr. Carlin, you saved about 4.5 minutes of your time.
I want to address a comment about the counsel's comment on the affidavits. Take a look at the two affidavits, both Mr. Mertz and Mr. Washman, go in great detail to demonstrate the underlying factual data upon which they opine. They do opine as to approximate cause. And that proximate cause as to damages that does affidavits to satisfy the standards under any rule. As far as Roberts is concerned,
does it satisfy the standard if the moving party directs its motion toward the issue of proximate causation of damages? Then, if the affidavit on the issue of proximate cause simply says the breach of the standard of care did approximately cause damages. Is that enough?
Yes. Yes. Because there's enough underlying factual data. If the Justice Cook, we would respect this, but that's why we have trials. The approximate cause, the threshold question is met. Now, whether you choose to believe the experts later or whether you choose to give any weight to this, that's a matter for the trial.
Without any facts and data supporting that, approximate cause. That's what the rule calls for.
But
I guess there was facts and data supporting the standard of breach of the standard of care.
I'm supporting the opinion of.
If you breach the standard of care, does that necessarily result in damages?
The experts in their affidavit says it wasn't direct approximate cause. These are the same affidavits of the same medical cases and the other professional liability cases day in and day out. And as far as Roberts is concerned, and just a closing comment on that, we would submit to you that if the court is inclined to extend it, it should only be extended in the context of professional services.
Thank you, Mr. Carlin. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.